Chapter 13. Night was still heavy in the sky. On open plains, from hilltops, and from the decks of solitary ships at sea, a distant low-lying line, that promised by and by to change to light, was visible in the dim horizon. But its promise was remote and doubtful, and the moon was striving with the night clouds busily. The shadows upon Redlaw's mind succeeded thick and fast to one another, and obscured its light as the night clouds hovered between the moon and earth, and kept the latter veiled in darkness. Fitful and uncertain as the shadows which the night clouds cast, were their concealments from him, and imperfect revelations to him, and, like the night clouds still, if the clear light broke forth for a moment, it was only that they might sweep over it, and make the darkness deeper than before. Without, there was a profound and solemn hush upon the ancient pile of building, and its buttresses and angles made dark shapes of mystery upon the ground, which now seemed to retire into the smooth white snow, and now seemed to come out of it, as the moon's path was more or less beset. Within, the chemist's room was indistinct and murky, by the light of the expiring lamp. A ghostly silence had succeeded to the knocking, and the voice outside. Nothing was audible, but, now and then, a low sound among the whitened ashes of the fire, as of its yielding up its last breath. Before it on the ground the boy lay fast asleep. In his chair, the chemist sat, as he had sat there since the calling at his door, had ceased like a man turned to stone. At such a time, the Christmas music he had heard before, began to play. He listened to it at first, as he had listened in the churchyard. But presently it playing still, and being borne towards him on the night air, in a low, sweet, melancholy strain he rose, and stood stretching his hands about him, as if there were some friend approaching within his reach, on whom his desolate touch might rest, yet do no harm. As he did this, his face became less fixed and wondering. A gentle trembling came upon him. And at last his eyes filled with tears, and he put his hands before them, and bowed down his head. His memory of sorrow, wrong, and trouble, had not come back to him. He knew that it was not restored. He had no passing belief or hope that it was. But some dumb stir within him made him capable, again, of being moved by what was hidden, afar off, in the music. If it were only that it told him sorrowfully the value of what he had lost, he thanked heaven for it with a fervent gratitude. As the last chord died upon his ear, he raised his head, to listen to its lingering vibration. Beyond the boy, so that his sleeping figure lay at its feet, the phantom stood, immovable and silent, with its eyes upon him. Ghastly it was, as it had ever been, but not so cruel and relentless in its aspect, or he thought or hoped so, as he looked upon it trembling. It was not alone, but in its shadowy hand it held another hand. And whose was that? Was the form, that stood beside it indeed Millie's, or but her shade and picture? The quiet head was bent a little, as her manner was, and her eyes were looking down, as if in pity, on the sleeping child. A radiant light fell on her face, but did not touch the phantom, for, though close beside her, it was dark and colorless as ever. "Spectre," said the chemist, newly troubled as he looked, "I have not been stubborn or presumptuous in respect of her. Oh, do not bring her here. Spare me that." "This is but a shadow," said the phantom. "When the morning shines, seek out the reality whose image I present before you." "Is it my inexorable doom to do so?" cried the chemist. "It is," replied the phantom. "To destroy her peace, her goodness, to make her what I am myself, and what I have made of others." "I have said seek her out," returned the phantom. "I have said no more." "Oh, tell me," exclaimed Redlaw, catching at the hope which he fancied might lie hidden in the words. "Can I undo what I have done?" "No," returned the phantom. "I do not ask for restoration to myself," said Redlaw. "What I abandoned of my own free will, and have justly lost. But for those to whom I have transferred the fatal gift, who never sought it, who unknowingly received a curse of which they had no warning, and which they had no power to shun, can I do nothing?" Nothing, said the phantom. If I cannot, can anyone? The phantom, standing like a statue, kept its gaze upon him for a while, then turned its head suddenly, and looked upon the shadow at its side. Ah! Can she? Cried Redlaw, still looking upon the shade. The phantom released the hand it had retained till now, and softly raised its own with a gesture of dismissal. Upon that, her shadow, still preserving the same attitude, began to move or melt away. Stay, cried Redlaw with an earnestness to which he could not give enough expression. For a moment, as an act of mercy, I know that some change fell upon me when those sounds were in the air just now. Tell me, have I lost the power of harming her? May I go near her without dread? Oh, let her give me any sign of hope. The phantom looked upon the shade as he did not at him, and gave no answer. At least, say this, has she, henceforth, the consciousness of any power to set right what I have done? She has not, the phantom answered. Has she the power bestowed on her without the consciousness? The phantom answered. Seek her out. And her shadow slowly vanished. They were face to face again, and looking on each other, as intently and awfully, as at the time of the bestowal of the gift, across the boy who still lay on the ground between them, at the phantom's feet. Terrible instructor, said the chemist, sinking on his knee before it, in an attitude of supplication, by whom I was renounced, but by whom I am revisited, in which, and in whose milder aspect, I would fain believe I have a gleam of hope, I will obey without inquiry, praying that the cry I have sent up in the anguish of my soul has been, or will be, heard, in behalf of those whom I have injured beyond human reparation. But there is one thing, you speak to me of what is lying here, the phantom interposed, and pointed with its finger to the boy. I do, returned the chemist. You know what I would ask. Why has this child alone been proof against my influence, and why, have I detected in its thoughts a terrible companionship with mine? This, said the phantom, pointing to the boy, is the last, completest illustration of a human creature, utterly bereft of such remembrances as you have yielded up. No softening memory of sorrow, wrong, or trouble enters here, because this wretched mortal from his birth, has been abandoned to a worse condition than the beasts, and has, within his knowledge, no one contrast, no humanizing touch, to make a grain of such a memory spring up in his hardened breast. All within this desolate creature is barren wilderness. All within the man bereft of what you have resigned, is the same barren wilderness. Woe to such a man! Woe, tenfold, to the nation, that shall count its monsters such as this, lying here, by hundreds and by thousands. Redlaw shrank, appalled, from what he heard. There is not, said the phantom, one of these, not one, but sows a harvest, that mankind must reap. From every seed of evil in this boy, a field of ruin is grown, that shall be gathered in, and garnered up, and sown again in many places in the world, until regions are overspread with wickedness enough to raise the waters of another deluge. Open and unpunished murder in a city's streets would be less guilty in its daily toleration than one such spectacle as this. It seemed to look down upon the boy in his sleep. Redlaw, too, looked down upon him with a new emotion. There is not a father, said the phantom, by whose side in his daily or his nightly walk, these creatures pass. There is not a mother among all the ranks of loving mothers in this land. There is no one risen from the state of childhood, but shall be responsible in his or her degree for this enormity. There is not a country throughout the earth on which it would not bring a curse. There is no religion upon earth that it would not deny. There is no people upon earth it would not put to shame. The chemist clasped his hands, and looked, with trembling fear and pity, from the sleeping boy to the phantom, standing above him with his finger pointing down. Behold, I say, pursued the specter, the perfect type of what it was your choice to be. Your influence is powerless here, because from this child's bosom you can banish nothing. His thoughts have been in terrible companionship with yours, because you have gone down to his unnatural level. He is the growth of man's indifference. You are the growth of man's presumption. The beneficent design of heaven is, in each case, overthrown, and from the two poles of the immaterial world you come together. The chemist stooped upon the ground beside the boy, and, with the same kind of compassion for him that he now felt for himself, covered him as he slept, and no longer shrank from him with abhorrence or indifference. Soon, now, the distant line on the horizon brightened, the darkness faded, the sun rose red and glorious, and the chimney stacks and gables of the ancient building gleamed in the clear air, which turned the smoke and vapor of the city into a cloud of gold. The very sundial in his shady corner, where the wind was used to spin with such unwindy constancy, shook off the finer particles of snow that had accumulated on his dull old face in the night, and looked out at the little white wreath settling round and round him. Doubtless some blind groping of the morning made its way down into the forgotten crypt so cold and earthy, where the Norman arches were half buried in the ground, and stirred the dull sap in the lazy vegetation hanging to the walls, and quickened the slow principle of life within the little world of wonderful and delicate creation which existed there, with some faint knowledge that the sun was up. The Tetterbys were up and doing. Mr. Tetterby took down the shutters of the shop, and, strip by strip, revealed the treasures of the window to the eyes, so proof against their seductions, of Jerusalem buildings. Adolphus had been out so long already, that he was halfway onto morning pepper. Five small Tetterbys, whose 10 round eyes were much inflamed by soap and friction, were in the tortures of a cool wash in the back kitchen, Mrs. Tetterby presiding. Johnny, who was pushed and hustled through his toilet with great rapidity, when Mollich chanced to be in an exacting frame of mind, which was always the case, staggered up and down with his charge before the shop door, under greater difficulties than usual, the weight of Mollich being much increased by a complication of defenses against the cold, composed of knitted worsted work, and forming a complete suit of chain armor, with a headpiece and blue gaiters. It was a peculiarity of this baby to be always cutting teeth. Whether they never came, or whether they came and went away again, is not in evidence, but it had certainly cut enough, on the showing of Mrs. Tetterby, to make a handsome dental provision for the sign of the bull and mouth. All sorts of objects were impressed for the rubbing of its gums, notwithstanding that it always carried, dangling at its waist, which was immediately under its chin, a bone ring, large enough to have represented the rosary of a young nun. Knife handles, umbrella tops, the heads of walking sticks selected from the stock, the fingers of the family in general, but especially of Johnny, nutmeg graters, crusts, the handles of doors, and the cool knobs on the tops of pokers, were among the commonest instruments indiscriminately applied for this baby's relief. The amount of electricity that must have been rubbed out of it in a week is not to be calculated. Still, Mrs. Tetterby always said it was coming through, and then the child would be herself. And still it never did come through, and the child continued to be somebody else. The tempers of the little Tetterbys had sadly changed with a few hours. Mr. and Mrs. Tetterby themselves were not more altered than their offspring. Usually they were an unselfish, good-natured, yielding little race, sharing short commons when it happened, which was pretty often, contentedly and even generously, and taking a great deal of enjoyment out of a very little meat. But they were fighting now, not only for the soap and water, but even for the breakfast which was yet in perspective. The hand of every little Tetterby was against the other little Tetterby's. And even Johnny's hand, the patient, much enduring, and devoted Johnny, rose against the baby. Yes, Mrs. Tetterby, going to the door by mere accident, saw him viciously pick out a weak place in the suit of armor, where a slap would tell, and slapped that blessed child. Mrs. Tetterby had him into the parlor by the collar, in that same flash of time, and repaid him the assault with usury thereto. "You brute, you murdering little boy," said Mrs. Tetterby. Had you the heart to do it? Why don't her teeth come through then? Retorted Johnny, in a loud rebellious voice, instead of bothering me. How would you like it yourself?
Like it, sir, said Mrs. Tetherby, relieving him of his dishonored load.
Yes, like it, said Johnny. How would you?
Not at all. If you was me, you'd go for a soldier.
I will too. There ain't no babies in the army.
Mr. Tetherby, who had arrived upon the scene of action, rubbed his chin thoughtfully, instead of correcting the rebel, and seemed rather struck by this view of a military life.
I wish I was in the army myself, if the child's in the right, said Mrs. Tetherby, looking at her husband, for I have no peace of my life here. I'm a slave, a Virginia slave. Some indistinct association with their weak descent on the tobacco trade perhaps suggested this aggravated expression to Mrs. Tetherby. I never have a holiday, or any pleasure at all, from year's end to year's end.
Why, Lord bless and save the child, said Mrs. Tetherby, shaking the baby with an irritability hardly suited to so pious an aspiration, what's the matter with her now?
Not being able to discover, and not rendering the subject much.
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.